afternoon. It's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Kristen Kay. Before Cambridge Analytica took a role in the 2016 presidential elections, they were working on midterm elections in Colorado.
After revoking a lease to allow a nonprofit to rent out the Aspen power plant, Aspen City Council is ready to sign a new lease with a new organization.
A bill addressing Colorado's pension fund is moving through the State House.
And art shows focused on the work of female artists are cropping up in the Roaring Fork Valley.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. Prospective homeowners hoping to buy into the Aspen-Pickens County Housing Authority program will soon be required to first take a homebuyer education course.
The course is similar to those required to get a federal loan from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. A financial expert goes through the home buying process, including finding a lender and making an offer. An APSHA representative then covers the specifics of bidding in the affordable housing lottery. Cindy Christensen, deputy director of APCHA, says they see residents who've had costs creep up on them during the buying process or upkeep and HOA fees once they've moved in that they hadn't accounted for.
This is kind of to open people's eyes so that they don't get into a bind. They don't end up losing their home. They don't end up getting behind in the mortgage or anything.
At least one person in each household will need to either attend a course in person or show a certificate of completion for the equivalent online course in order to submit an application for deed-restricted units. The hope is to offer the courses monthly. This month's class is this evening from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Limelight Hotel.
Thanks to a strong February, overall winter occupancy in Aspen and Snowmass Village is pacing within one percentage point of last year. Wyatt Orme has more.
As far as occupancy goes, February in Aspen this year was the same as last year, with a rate of about 75%. Snowmass, however, set a new record with 78% occupancy. Thus far, March in both Aspen and Snowmass is lagging behind last year. However, April looks strong, considering Easter Sunday falls on the first of the month. United has extended their full winter flight schedules through April 8th and has also added a fifth daily trip from Denver throughout April and May. Wyatt Orme, Aspen Public Radio News.
Wilderness Workshop has selected the five artists they will bring to Aspen this summer as part of the Artists in Wilderness residency. The week-long program allows artists to create using local open space as inspiration. Kristen spoke to two of the winners of the residency.
Mary Hughes and Carol Gray Bosca have worked together for 20 years. When they got word that they had won the residency from Wilderness Workshop, they were shocked. Gray Bosca says it was a wonderful surprise.
I thought there's no way we were going to get it.
And Hughes had a similar reaction.
I almost fell off my chair.
Gray Bosca says the experience will bring them new perspective.
Very often, you know, you get into nature and it's much different than seeing it on TV or on a website. And it's so vast, and I think that it will inspire great things.
For the first time this year, Wilderness Workshop selected all jewelry artists. The residency runs in late summer and early fall.
1 in 10 Coloradans gets a retirement through the Public Employee Pension System, or PERA. But without legislative changes, there won't be enough money to keep the plan solvent. Benta Berkland has more.
Republican Senator Jack Tate of Centennial is the main sponsor of Senate Bill 200. Among other things, it would increase the amount both employees and employers contribute and change the way retirement is calculated.
There is a problem with salary spiking. If you look at the private sector, and really a lot of folks outside of PERA, which is the majority of Coloradans, their retirement is based on their average salary throughout their whole careers.
But Democrats disagree on how far the proposal should go. Democrats offered more than a dozen amendments on Monday to try to minimize the impacts to retirees, including lowering how much the minimum age for retirement would have to go up. Those amendments were defeated. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
The bill passed the Colorado Senate Tuesday and now moves on to the House.
One of the biggest lakes in the Southwest is shrinking. Southern California's Salton Sea is home to many fish and bird species and is sustained by Colorado River water that's drained through nearby farms. But as Luke Runyon reports, the lake is also an unfolding ecological crisis with implications throughout the Colorado River watershed.
Jessica LaVecchio is pointing down to the Salton Sea and its thousands of acres of dry, dusty shoreline from the top of a jagged hillside. She's in charge of air quality projects for the Imperial Irrigation District.
This is our surface roughening and vegetation enhancement project.
The IID is the single largest user on the Colorado River. It delivers water to farms that grow the majority of the country's winter vegetables, including lettuce and broccoli. But LaVecchio's crews are doing a different kind of farming. They're plowing up the ever-expanding beach.
So any dust that is being picked up off the surface right here, hopefully will fall into a furrow.
The dust is so bad it's killed crops and aggravated asthma for residents of this valley, not far from Palm Springs. But what makes the situation so mind-boggling is the Salton Sea shouldn't even be here. An engineering mishap more than 100 years ago caused the Colorado River to spill into this desert basin.
This Salton Sea serves two purposes. It's become a man-made ecological treasure, as well as become a man-made ecological problem.
That's Luis Olmedo. He's the director of the nonprofit Comité Cívico del Valle. It was founded by local farm workers about 30 years ago with a focus on environmental justice. And lately, air quality.
Every inch of water that is removed from this sea is exposing a hazardous waste landfill. That is a big threat to our community.
Today, the Salton Sea is almost twice as salty as the Pacific Ocean, and it's getting saltier. As a result, some fish species have vanished, starving the migratory birds that stop here. So how did things get so bad? Well, Michael Cohen says the lake's decline can be traced back to an agreement between the San Diego County Water Authority and the Imperial Irrigation District. Cohen is a senior researcher with the Pacific Institute, a water think tank.
Back in 2002, 2003, there was an understanding that taking water from IID meant as IID becomes more efficient, less water flows to the Salton Sea.
The district is selling more and more water to San Diego in exchange for irrigation upgrades for its farmers. So essentially, water that was keeping the lake full is being redirected toward bathroom faucets.
Which means the Salton Sea shrinks, which is exactly what we're seeing.
But Cohen says there's been a slow or even non-existent response to the lake's decline. California has a 10-year plan in place to address some of the problems, but not all of them, according to Bruce Wilcox.
One is a longer-term issue of what the sea might look like in, say, 20 years, 15 years.
Wilcox oversees Salton Sea policy for the state.
And the other is the fact that we are woefully behind in implementing anything.
That's why the Imperial Irrigation District wants assurances that it's not alone in paying for the problems the shrinking lake creates. The IID is prepared to push for those assurances before signing on to a multi-state water agreement among Arizona, California, and Nevada. It would cut back the amount of water the states can have during prolonged droughts. Again, the Pacific Institute's Michael Cohen.
The environmental community, the water agencies, I suspect most of the farmers agree we should be doing things like this. So it's not even a lack of consensus. It's just a lack of political will.
Back on the shoreline, the Imperial Irrigation District's Jessica LaVecchio and others have adopted the phrase smaller but sustainable to describe the Salton Sea's future. In that motto, there's a resignation that the lake will never be what it once was.
I'm from the Imperial Valley. I grew up here, so it has a special place in my heart. I would like to see it as, you know, a place that I can bring my kids, future grandkids, to come and enjoy.
That will depend on the ability to manage the lake's decline, a responsibility that's not just limited to this area, but the entire Colorado River watershed. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story was produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation. You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. You can stay informed about local news even when you're away from your radio by liking us on Facebook.
Like this week, you can see Anderson Ranch visiting artist Glenn Kino in his workshop.
Plus, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook. The Aspen Chamber Resort Association will likely be housed within the city-owned old power plant through at least 2022.
The new lease agreement goes before the city council tonight. It lays out the terms allowing ACRA to rent out the bottom floor of the power plant while new city offices are being built at Galena Plaza, where the chamber had previously been located. The nonprofit will pay the city about $4,000 a month, or just under $20 a square foot. ACRA is also expected to pay 40% of the building utilities, which they share with city offices that occupy the second floor of the building. The agreement acknowledges that the lease term is meant to last through the building of the new Civic Plaza. As part of that development, the city is accounting for ACRA remaining in city-owned property, either in the new building or what is now City Hall, the Armory Building on Galena and Hopkins.
The Rotary Club of Aspen is sponsoring the third annual Extemporaneous Speech Contest for high schoolers on April 18th. Wyatt Orm reports.
Extemporaneous is a fancy word for on the spot. So participants in the contest will choose a topic from several options, then take a half hour to prepare a short speech, which they deliver in front of a panel of judges. According to the Rotary Club of Aspen, extemporaneous speaking is a great way for young people to hone the ability to think critically on their feet. All high school students from Aspen to Rifle are eligible to enter. The deadline is April 11th. The first place prize is $1,000. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Several current and upcoming art exhibitions in the Roaring Fork Valley are focused on the work of female artists. In Aspen, the Bird's Nest Gallery has just opened a show called Rise. The Art Base in Basalt has a group photography show called Body of Work, featuring three young women raised in the Roaring Fork Valley. The Aspen Art Museum is also highlighting women this summer.
Kristen sat down to talk about this trend with Carolyn Heldman.
So why the groundswell of female-centered shows right now?
Well, it seems like it might be because of the national conversation and the Me Too movement, but actually the idea for all of these shows came together well before last fall. So Sky Wineglass, the owner of The Bird's Nest, has been planning Rise for about a year and a half. And Jenna Moe, the executive director at the Art Base, says this isn't just a new trend, that the art world is just like the larger culture, and these conversations about objectification and empowering women have been going on for a long time. Although she did note that they're getting a lot more attention now. And Jamie J. Fletcher is one of the photographers at the Art Base. She talked about what led her to start wrestling with these perceptions of women. So here's Fletcher at the opening.
I've kind of changed from this, you know, childlike figure to this sexualized object.
So this is something she's been thinking about for literally her entire adult life.
What are local artists addressing in their work right now?
All of these exhibits and artists look at the strengths and challenges of being female in really unique ways. So Jamie J. Fletcher's photography is really bold. She uses images that are kind of like the typical sexualized or commercialized poses that you see women in advertising. And then she puts some twist on them, like a big, violent, bright red square or twine wrapped really tightly around a torso. Lena Nicholson's images are softer and much more abstract and ethereal. And Metzli Esparza uses screens to project things onto the bodies of women, and there are these kind of ominous shadows all around them. And my reaction was like, what's lurking back there? Like, what's unseen in this image?
Wow.
Rise at the Bird's Nest is highlighting six different artists, and there's just a huge variety, and it's wild. There's a lot of female warrior and goddess imagery, sculpture of women's bodies that's made by their bodies. There's some humor at that show. So all very different approaches, but what's interesting is that over and over, all the artists discussed empowerment, empowering women to question society's expectations and to be proud of their identities and bodies.
So even though it's not as a direct result of Me Too and Time's Up, it seems like it just sort of part of the zeitgeist somehow, it percolated into our valley even without intention.
Mm-hmm. I think that the cultural moment is definitely present in the context of these shows. It seems like the artists and the curators, they want to acknowledge darkness and the reckoning that's happened and really emphasize moving forward now in positive ways. So the Bird's Nest exhibit, for example, is called Rise, right? And Wineglass was clear that she wants this show to be a celebration of women's power and pride. Here's another body of work artist, Lena Nicholson, on this.
There's not much positivity to sexual harassment, sexual assault, rape, but at the same time, I think there needs to be a positivity in moving forward of we're making progress. Things are open. There's acceptance.
Nicholson's photos are the ones I mentioned that have a lot of soft colors and a lot of light, and that's intentional on her part. She talked about how she wanted to celebrate her own strength and the strength of women in her photography.
Do you think this is the beginning of a trend locally?
So art lovers in the Valley will certainly see more of this summer at the Aspen Art Museum. They're saying that women artists are really leading their exhibitions this summer. And at least for Jenna Moe from the Art Base, there's tension in singling out and segregating women in these shows. Mm. She talked about how exciting it was to support these up-and-coming artists, but she wants these shows to work themselves out of a job.
You know, the Women's Surrealism show at the Denver Art Museum was amazing, but why do we have to have a Women's Surrealism show? Why can't we just have equal representation in the normal show? So I'd like to get to the point where it's not necessarily calling out women as being different, but just more representation.
So ultimately, it'll be interesting to see if female-centered shows like this are that stepping stone toward gender balance in the art world. And I think also if the culture as a whole is in the same place these artists are, kind of ready to pick up the pieces and move forward.
It's very cool. Thanks.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Wednesday was the final Aspen U presentation from the Aspen Skiing Company this season. The talk featured Brian Dunbar, executive director of the Institute for Built Environment at Colorado State University.
Allison caught up with him to talk about his work, which looks at regenerative design in built environments, with an eye for how users of the space will feel while inside.
So I want to get into your work, which looks at regenerative design and built environments, but I kind of want to start by de-buzzwording some of those things. What are we talking about when we say built environment?
Yes, well, the built environment is anything that's been human-formed from the natural environment. So our cities, our buildings, our sidewalks, our parks, our roads, those are all considered the built environment.
A lot of times if you're thinking of a new development, first of all, you're thinking of one building that has literal architectural blueprints. And it sounds like what you do is look broader, neighborhoods, cities, and you think there's a way to develop them to make people happier and healthier. How does that come into play?
Yeah, you're right. You know, one of the things I'm going to talk about is the word hope. And how do we arrive at that? There are ways to inject hope into our future.
Does this mean bright colors, painted happy faces, architects,
It sure could. Okay. Yeah, and it should. That's why we believe that there's a process of bringing people together and hearing from all voices before we set off on designing and building something. What would hope mean for that neighborhood or that group of people that are going to use that place?
So bringing in sociology and psychology into design.
Exactly. And biology, our director of research for our institute is a professor in sociology. And she's taught me a lot about human behavior and what makes people really go. And so we're injecting those things into our work.
Is there anything that translates among all of the different projects you've worked on? Is there something that just makes humans happy and healthy?
I think I will go back to the term hope. Like, if we can find common ground and not dwell on the problems, but dwell on solutions or potential, we really like to look at potential. We're working on a project in Australia where the land has been damaged from years of misuse, and we're working with the people in the area to try to help them see a land that all of a sudden would be growing healthy things, a place for good recreation. And so it doesn't take a long time for them to say, yeah, bring that on. We need that.
And so you do have this environmental aspect to your work as well, these practices of maybe not just offsetting some of the environmental damage that development could have, but even providing a benefit through thinking of these projects. Can you explain what you look at to see if you can have a net positive?
Yeah, and that really is the shift that we're talking about is, you know, it's important to do less bad. Like, it's important to use less energy and less water and have less waste. But what we're talking about is actually finding benefit, as you said.
And maybe this circles back to our first question about regenerative design.
Yeah. You know, for years, our institute's been around for 25 years now. And I'd say for the first close to 20 years, our focus was on sustainability. And then we realized that's not enough. It's important, but it's not enough. And so we hit on this concept that some others around the world are talking about, and that is, how could we regenerate? And, you know, a forest has to regenerate once it has a fire, your injury to your elbow has to regenerate. So we're talking about the same thing with our cities and our built environment. Can they regenerate?
Brian Dunbar is the executive director of the Institute for the Built Environment at Colorado State University. He's speaking tonight at the Limelight Hotel. Brian, thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
To hear an extended conversation with Brian Dunbar, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Kristen Kay. Join Aspen Public Radio this evening for What's Up with Congress, a conversation with NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis and the Aspen Institute's Kitty Boone, discussing the current state of Congress and previewing the 2018 midterm elections.
Doors open at 6:30 at the Temporary in Willits. Tickets for the main event and a special cocktail reception hosted by Bowtie Cinemas are available now, aspenpublicradio.org.
Colorado State Senator Carrie Donovan says she believes the controversial data firm Cambridge Analytica assisted her 2014 Republican rival.
The company, now under scrutiny for mining Facebook data to target political messaging in the 2016 presidential race, shopped their services around to Republican State House hopefuls in 2014, according to the Denver Post. At that time, District 5, which includes Eagle and Pitkin counties, was newly redrawn and hotly contested. Democrat Carrie Donovan won the seat by 1,200 votes, one of the tightest races in the state. She says the opposition used negative campaign tactics throughout.
We had over 50 negative mailers in my race alone. And looking back now on some of them that they're flagging in other races, I mean, those were the same ones that were in my race.
Cambridge Analytica and its Colorado subsidiaries allegedly searched Facebook users' posts, likes, and networks to identify which voters could be highly swayed by partisan messaging.
The top Democratic leader in the state Senate has stepped down from her leadership position, saying she can no longer work with Republicans because of their handling of sexual harassment allegations. Benta Berkland has more.
Senator Lucia Guzman says she's disappointed Senate President Kevin Grantham hasn't called for consequences for three Republican senators after independent investigations found their accusers credible.
I am human and I can no longer work or even look in the eyes of the president and the leadership.
But she says the last straw was when a Republican senator filed a complaint against a Democrat, alleging that he wrongfully used the women's restroom.
It is a total lie that this man deliberately would go into the bathroom, the women's bathroom, time after time in order to offend women.
In a statement, Kevin Grantham says he's disappointed to learn of her departure in that leadership position and her reasons for doing so, but he says he hopes to continue to proactively work with her. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
On Friday, a collaborative art show called Word is Bond opens in Carbondale. Kristen talked to the artists, who likened working together to a conversation.
Carbondale-based visual artists Stanley Bell and Takeo Hiramitsu worked together to create several of the paintings on display for Word is Bond. Bell says starting a painting, then turning it over to Hiramitsu, led to new creativity.
We would work individually, then we'd swap out pieces, and then we'd come back together, and towards the end here, we'd work together. So, you know, the conversation that happened with the reaction was freeing in a sense.
The pair say they have similar styles, and this made the process easier. But they still had to give up what Hiramitsu describes as hyper-individualism. The two artists also worked separately on individual pieces for the exhibit. Word is Bond opens Friday at the Launch Pad in Carbondale.
Throughout the Valley, house concerts are happening more frequently. Claire Woodcock has been exploring the scene and brings us this report.
30 chairs fit easily in Jackson Emmer's living room, where musicians perform on a platform by the stairs. About 2 hours before guests begin to trickle in, Emmer sent out a Facebook message to come, regardless of the bad weather.
If you're going to like a folk singer-songwriter, country, honky-tonk, bluegrass, house concert, generally the premise is the host invites people. It's not on the artist to draw an audience.
Emmer found tonight's band, Hooten Holler, in Asheville, where he lived before moving back to Carbondale.
He said, anytime you're passing through, we'll set up a house concert, so he's making good on his word.
That's Amy Alvey. She plays fiddle in Hooten Holler. House concerts are some of her band's favorite venues to play because of the kind of audiences they attract. House concerts offer more hospitality than, say, a bar gig, like a home-cooked meal or a bed to crash in. Here's Emmer again.
There's a lot of trust that is built into this, and it's never backfired on me. People have always been really sweet.
Olivia Emmer is co-hosting tonight. She says house concerts are great for up-and-coming bands.
It's just great to like create an environment that's really like welcoming for listeners and for the players. And there's a really strong sense of community that comes when you are at a house concert.
The Emmers are not the only ones hosting house concerts in the Valley. Other regular hosts include John Field in Carbondale and Daniel Sadowski, a.k.a. Pastor Mustard, on Aspen Public Radio. The tradition of hosting small house concerts has roots that go way back to the folk scene, says Hooten Holler's guitarist Mark Kiliensky.
There's kind of this story that's been fed to us since the 1920s that's been marketed by record companies, which is that there's black music and there's white music.
In the 1920s and 30s, record companies marketed blues to African-American audiences and country music to white audiences. But there's always been crossover. Emmer calls the house concert scene in the Roaring Fork Valley patchy, but says it has potential.
Here, it just seems like anytime somebody wants to throw something together, they do. And I think that's great, and I would love to see more of it.
The rules vary from house to house. Some offer free beer, wine, and a cheese and cracker platter. Others offer a home-cooked meal. Emmer says figuring out logistics for a show tend to be the most tricky. That and finding enough chairs.
That's maybe the toughest thing.
The internet has made house concerts more accessible. Shows that used to be limited to an inner circle have expanded their reach, especially through Facebook. But even through a network of friends, the events are still treated as professional gigs. Hosts often put out a tip jar. Olivia Emmer explains.
When you invite your friends and your network into your home, the expectations need to be really clear that, like, this is still a concert and the musicians need to make money to be able to, like, fill their gas tank and make it to the next stop.
One regular in the house concert scene is Natalie Spears. She alternates between banjo and piano for Pearl and Wood, a Carbondale-based band opening the show at the Emmers. She says she appreciates the intimate venue and is glad the scene is growing.
I feel much more connected to an audience, and I think it really fosters a deeper intimacy between audience and performer, which is what I would prefer to engage with.
The connection is mutual. Guests are 3 feet away from the performers. The sound system is stripped down, and there's no separation between the artists and their audience. And many prefer it that way. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Kristen Kay. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.